Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Laura Landon, and welcome to the New Books Network. Those are the famous chimes used on the National Broadcasting Company radio networks from the earliest days of radio in the 1920s. And one of the most distinctive voices heard on the NBC and later the CBS radio networks from those early days was the clear, compelling baritone of the journalist Lowell Thomas. In his new book, The Voice of America, Lowell Thomas and the Invention of 20th Century Journalism, Mitchell Stevens says, "I think it's safe to say that never in the history of American journalism has one person told the news to as large a percentage of the American population as Lowell Thomas did in the 1940s, at a very crucial time in the history of the United States, during the Second World War, the bloodiest in history." Lowell Thomas's voice first appeared on American radio in 1925, but it was a few years later, in 1930, that Thomas began his nightly weekday newscasts that continued for 46 years until May 14, 1976.
From Salisbury, Rhodesia, from Moscow, and from Islamabad, Pakistan comes today's news. Good evening, everybody. This is Lowell Thomas.
That's the opening of Lowell Thomas's last radio newscast, courtesy of the audio archives at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. But as Mitchell Stevens points out in his biography, Thomas did not confine himself to radio journalism. He embraced all of the new media in the 20th century as he traveled to faraway places and brought back films and photos to share with audiences, first at his many illustrated lectures and later on television. Stevens points out, for example, that 2 million people all over the world attended Lowell Thomas's illustrated lectures on the First World War exploits of Lawrence of Arabia and the Arab struggles against the Turkish Ottoman Empire. Those lectures made both Thomas and T.E. Lawrence household names. During the Second World War, Lowell Thomas's voice was also heard by millions of filmgoers in movie-tone newsreels. According to Mitchell Stevens, Thomas invented a 20th-century style of fact-based journalism that was authoritative and nonpartisan. And, as you'll hear in the interview that follows, Stevens writes about Lowell Thomas's long career from the point of view of a journalism historian, the author of A History of News, a text widely used in journalism history courses. Stevens, who is a professor of journalism at the Carter Institute at New York University, is the author of 5 other books on journalism and media. He joined us to talk about The Voice of America, Lowell Thomas, and the Invention of 20th Century Journalism from an NYU studio in New York City. The interviewer is Canadian journalist Bruce Wark.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Mitch, to talk about your new book.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I have to start by asking you about the title of your new book, The Voice of America, Lowell Thomas and the Invention of 20th Century Journalism. What does that title mean, especially that part about the invention of 20th century journalism?
Well, the first word after the article voice is really important, because this is a man who had an exceptional voice and one of certainly the three best known voices in America for 2-3 decades. And he also spoke to America in a way no one before him really had. And the second part of the title, The Invention of 20th Century Journalism, is something that really fascinates me as a journalism professor and a journalism historian. This kind of journalism that many of us grew up into, if you were born in the 20th century, you were born into a kind of journalism, did not always exist. It did have to be invented. And I think Lowell Thomas played a major role in the creation of this type of journalism. It's what we call traditional journalism today. And I think 21st century journalism is, in many ways, defining itself against this 20th century journalism that Lowell Thomas helped invent.
Well, I'll ask you about that, but first the voice part of your title. You describe his voice as large, deep, resonant, and precise in one place, and in another, a voice that was rich and bracing, even a bit tart. Where did that voice come from?
I think he was probably born into part of it from his mother's side. He says his mother, who was a very religious woman, would have the loudest voice in church, the voice that was easiest to hear in the choir. And the other half came from his father, who was obsessed with the importance of speaking clearly, with elocution. And he gave him intensive instruction in speaking when Lowell was a child.
A kind of instruction that we don't do anymore.
No, we don't. And boy, this served him in good stead. I mean, you could hear his voice always. He was an incredibly clear speaker. He could captivate an audience in many ways, but in part through his voice. And when he first auditioned for the radio, it was a really natural fit.
Let's listen to a bit of Lowell Thomas's voice here. This is from a broadcast in 1957.
Vice President Nixon received with popular acclaim and royal honors in Morocco today in the city of Rabat, mobbed by crowds of Muslims, dark-robed men, veiled women, barefoot children. Dick Nixon says he likes personal contact, of which there was a lot today, as he shook outstretched hands and patted the heads of children. Then at the royal palace, Sultan Mohammed bin Yusuf received him with an honor that made Moroccans gape, having him take a gold chair at the right of the Sultan, which position by custom is reserved for royalty.
So that was the voice of Lowell Thomas with his famous radio broadcast, radio newscast, in 1957. Mitch Stevens, you were saying, though, that the title of your book, the second part, The Invention of 20th Century Journalism, you said some things about that, mainstream journalism and so forth. How else would you characterize 20th century journalism, the kind that Lowell Thomas practiced?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about what he introduced or helped introduce to journalism and what we're losing today. Because journalism is undergoing so many changes today and dealing with some of its limitations today in very interesting ways. And the two words that most, well, I would say three words that most come to mind. The first is authoritative. I think it was his voice came across as an authoritative voice. And I think we got used to that in the 20th century. He was followed by Edward R. Murrow and his authoritative voice, and by Huntley and Brinkley, and then Walter Cronkite, and then Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather and Peter Jennings. The second word that comes to mind is trusted. I think this voice was heard At 6:45 each evening on a 15-minute newscast, and there weren't really other voices almost most of the time on this newscast. It was just Lowell Thomas's voice at a prime spot on in the radio schedule, because he came on right before Amos and Andy, a show with some unpleasant depictions of African Americans, unfortunately, but that was very widely listened to, and. And he came in at the dinner hour or right after the dinner hour. And I've collected, there's so many stories from around the United States and Canada of people who were eating dinner. And then when Lowell Thomas would come on, all conversation would stop and they'd listen for 15 minutes. And as one person wrote, as soon as he said, "So long until tomorrow," his sign off, then dessert would be brought out and people would eat. So this was a family institution in the United States in the 1930s and 1940s and into the 1950s. And he was a trusted character. Somebody said, if Lowell Thomas said it, it must be true. So authoritative, trusted. And the final word, which is, I think, really significant for understanding what 20th century journalism became, is nonpartisan. You know, Lowell Thomas had a politics. He supported Republicans from Teddy Roosevelt through Ronald Reagan. The sponsor of his show for a long time was Sun Oil Company, owned by the very right-wing Pew family. And who were sort of like the Koch brothers today in their politics. But still, Lowell Thomas tried to play it, as he put it, down the middle. And he didn't want to alienate Democratic listeners or Republican listeners. You know, as a journalism historian, I had researchers counting the number of times he mentioned President Franklin Roosevelt, the number of times he mentioned his challengers, or during the Hoover-Roosevelt election, how many times President Hoover was mentioned, how many times President Roosevelt was mentioned, and what negative or positive things he said about them. He was very balanced. He really aimed for a nonpartisan newscast, and it didn't have to be that way. There were other lesser figures in radio news who were much more partisan, anti-Roosevelt, for example, or pro-Roosevelt. And it wasn't that way in a lot of other countries. You know, France ended up with a more partisan radio news and then television news. A number of Western countries did. But the United States had a tradition for a long time that broadcast news was supposed to be nonpartisan, play it down the middle, and this can be traced to Lowell Thomas.
Well, Mitch, let's talk a bit now about Lowell Thomas's background. He was born in Ohio, but he grew up in a Colorado gold mining town. How would you say that his early experiences in the American West shaped him and his approach to journalism?
You know, he had an amazing childhood at 9,000 feet in the Rocky Mountains on one of the slopes of Pikes Peak, in a town that had a huge vein of gold underneath it. And there were mines all over the place. The whole town was undermined by gold mines. And so he grew up among miners. He worked in the mines. He had a job writing essay for mining companies, picking up gold samples, taking them to be analyzed. He was on horseback all the time. His father was a town doctor and would also take him on geological expeditions, collecting rocks. It was an outdoors childhood, and it was a childhood lived among some real characters, people who had traveled the world looking, trying to make their fortune. And this this sort of boom or bust mentality, this bet your bottom dollar mentality, became very much his mentality. He was a risk taker. He didn't worry about money. He was always willing to gamble on himself.
One thing that surprised me as I read your book was the fact that Lowell Thomas earned four university degrees and served for a brief time on the law faculty at Princeton. Yet, as you point out in your book, he was more storyteller than academic. I'm wondering how you would characterize his academic career and his intellectual approach to things.
Well, first of all, we have to understand that this was a man who impressed people quickly. So when he shows up at law school in Chicago to take some night courses, the dean of the law school very quickly asks him to teach a course himself for the entire student body in public speaking. When he enrolls in the graduate program at Princeton University, one of the few people from out west to be studying there, certainly one of the least rich people at Princeton in the graduate program at the time. He studied for a year, and then they asked him to join the faculty. So he impressed people. And he also, he did what he needed to do. He accomplished things. He showed up at college in Indiana, and he enrolled in all the freshman courses, and he thought, this is pretty easy. I think I'll take the sophomore courses at the same time. And he ended up graduating with a BA and a BS in 2 years. And then he went to Denver University and got another BA and plus a master's degree. So his father loved education, and so there was a lot of pressure on him to go to school. And boy, did he accomplish it well, although he was not an intellectual, and a library doing research was never the right place for him.
In fact, I think he taught oratory at the university.
Yeah, he taught, he was always ready to teach speaking and teach public speaking, which was a very important discipline in universities in those days. And he knew it. He understood it. He had strong opinions on the subject. Don't read from a prepared text. Anytime I read from a prepared text, I feel Lowell looking over my shoulder scornfully.
Now, Lowell Thomas helped pay for his education by working as a reporter at Chicago newspapers, starting, I think, around 1913, when he was only 21. And in fact, you point out in your book that he actually occupied a desk next to Ben Hecht, the co-author of The Front Page, the famous play that you characterize about the hijinks and low adventures of early 20th century journalism. How did that rough and tumble Chicago newspaper world shape Lowell Thomas's journalism?
Well, I think he got quite a training in journalism, not always in a positive way, from his from his 2 years working for a newspaper in Chicago. This was American journalism at perhaps its wildest. Chicago was a pretty wild place in those days, with lots of drinking, lots of keeping reporters sober was a big issue at the newspaper he worked for, lots of crime, lots of, illicit romance and corruption. And Lowell Thomas covered it all. And, this period in Chicago journalism is well captured, as you said, in the play by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, The Front Page, made into a wonderful movie, which I highly recommend, His Girl Friday, made into a few movies, but that's one of the best versions of it. And, not the most ethical journalism all the time. As I like to put it, Lowell had two big scoops in his 2 years in Chicago journalism, and one of them was really true.
Right. Yes. I read about the one where he actually invented an interview with an heiress, Helen Morton, I think, and they printed it as, obviously as though he had conducted the interview, but it was really fictitious.
Yeah, he made up an interview with this woman, the heir to the Morton Salt fortune, near Chicago, and kind of got caught. He thought in those days people had a much looser attitude towards those things, alas, than we do today. Today you'd be fired immediately for that I think, properly. But, you know, Ben Hecht, who had the desk right across from his, was known for inventing things like the Great Chicago Earthquake. And he and the photographer dug a trench in the park out there and went into his landlady's house and broke some dishes and got it on the front page, Hecht claims. And so making up stories wasn't considered the big deal it is today, but it was an unfortunate period in, certainly from my point of view, in Lowell's career as a journalist.
Now, one thing that strikes me about this is that, as you point out in your book, Chicago newspaper journalism of that day was pretty local, pretty parochial, and yet Lowell Thomas went on to become a great international journalist, a great internationalist in his radio broadcasts. I guess it's the changing media and the changing reach of media from local to national to international that occurred during Lowell Thomas's career.
It occurred during Lowell Thomas's career, this switch to a more international perspective, and I think Lowell Thomas played a major role in it. Because once you, Chicago was interested in stories about Chicago, and oh yes, World War I was starting. And, when he worked for newspapers in Denver and they were interested in stories about Denver, there might be a story about something happened in Sweden if they were giving an award to somebody from Denver. And, you know, and it was sort of true in New York, too. It was journalism was primarily a local business, and the newspapers were all local. And in 1930, Lowell Thomas, who came from this this newspaper journalism background, took over, after a few months, the first national network radio newscasts that could be heard by people all around the country. And that really changed the nature of news. Now, a different person taking over such a newscast might still have focused on just the United States and what was going on in the United States. But Lowell had, he was a man who was really interested in the world and, you know, already beginning to travel the world. And actually his two news writers were also people with international backgrounds, immigrant parents or, people who paid attention to events overseas. So this newscast introduced some very interesting international characters to American listeners in the 1930s, characters like Franco in Spain, like Hitler in Germany, like Churchill in England, like Stalin in Russia. So this in some ways, this newscast was preparing the United States for the international role it was going to have to play.
You're listening to a New Books Network interview with Mitchell Stevens, author of The Voice of America, Lowell Thomas and the Invention of 20th Century Journalism. It's the spring of 1915, and Lowell Thomas is on a train heading west from Chicago, carrying a brand new tool he would need to write about his travels. Here's an excerpt from Chapter 3. Amongst the luggage Lowell had carried on board was one of the latest advances in human communication, a portable typewriter. Newspapermen had been early adopters of typewriters. Lowell would describe himself as helpless without one. So before he set out on this journey, Lowell had managed to obtain a Corona 3. This machine, as he often called it, had debuted in 1912 and had a carriage that folded down on top of its keyboard, enabling it to tuck inside a relatively trim case. The Corona was not quite, in today's terms, a laptop. Though Lowell sometimes balanced it there, effective operation required that it rest on something harder, flatter, and higher than a pair of thighs. Nonetheless, this was the first decent typewriter someone could comfortably lug around.
Now, Mitch, so far we've talked about Lowell Thomas's career in radio and his career in Chicago newspapers before that. I was interested in reading in your book an aspect of Lowell Thomas's career that I did not know a lot about. In 1915, equipped with a portable typewriter, a fairly new technology in those days, and free railroad passes, Lowell Thomas set off to see the American West and ended up in Alaska. How did those travels, shape the next phase of his career?
Well, he went to Alaska almost by accident, and, a railroad executive asked him if he wanted to go and try the new railroads out there. And this is a man who's a great public speaker, who's been trained by his father at public speaking, even though he's so young. And when he got back to the East Coast, this is just when he was starting to go to school study in the graduate program at Princeton, he got into his head the idea that he might lecture on Alaska. Now, it tells you something about Lowell Thomas's self-confidence that he was lecturing in Alaska after having spent, about a week in Alaska, most of it sleeping on a ship. But man, he did his homework and he found slides, and he became a very successful lecturer on Alaska. Later went back and learned more and filmed more and got more images. And lecturing, these travelogues, as they were called, were a really interesting form of journalism in those days. People would come and look at pictures, some early film. These are the days before sound film, and listen to people talk about these far corners of the earth. So Lowell put together a pretty good business for himself while he was still in the graduate program at Princeton, traveling around the country, delivering lectures on this new territory of the United States. This is well before it became a state, Alaska.
Now, let's talk a bit about the First World War. You actually begin your book with a brief account of Lowell Thomas's encounter with T.E. Lawrence in 1918 during the First World War. Why was Lowell Thomas's encounter with Lawrence of Arabia so important for his development as a journalist?
T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, was Lowell's big breakthrough. That's what really made him well known, because that's what really made Lawrence of Arabia well known. So this is Lowell assigned himself to cover World War I with his typical chutzpah, his typical self-confidence, and went over there with a cameraman, got some funding, and covered things in France and Belgium and Italy, covered some fighting, got some film that not many people were getting. And then he heard that British forces had taken Jerusalem from the Turks. They had Christians, this is not an attractive account, had liberated Jerusalem. And Lowell had a nose for news, and he sensed there was a story there. And he got permission from the military authorities to go over to the Middle East. And while he was in Jerusalem, he tells a version of this story that probably is not correct. He says he just saw him on the street. He probably was introduced to him in another British officer's office. This blue-eyed, blonde-haired, short man, beardless man, who was wearing Arab robes, who was in full Arab garb. This also struck somebody with a nose for news as quite interesting. And he spent a lot of time talking to Lawrence, finding out about him, and Lawrence got more and more interesting. Lawrence was riding camels and helping lead. How much of a role he played is still a matter of controversy in the 100 or so books that have been written on the subject afterwards. He found out that this guy was helping or participating or leading the Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire, against the Turks, as part of World War I on the side of the British. And Lowell got permission to go to Aqaba, to go to Arabia, and camp with Lawrence of Arabia, take photos of him on camel. He didn't get to cover any blowing up trains or battles, although he kind of fudged that in some of what he would write about it. He got film of all this. And he went back and he ended up producing some lectures on World War I. And by far the most popular was a lecture that had Lawrence of Arabia in it. And partly this is because World War I was a particular grim and bloody war. A lot of the fighting in Europe was just in trenches, and the war was stalemated for a long time. He was the part of World War I that the sun shone on, riding camels across the desert. And World War I had not been a war that produced lots of heroes. Here was a hero, a British hero. And when he presented the lecture in London, it was a huge hit. And the Queen came, and the Prime Minister came, and the French Prime Minister came, and Winston Churchill came, and Rudyard Kipling came. And it was the hottest ticket in London, this story of an Englishman riding camels and helping lead the Arab revolt. He ended up giving this lecture before 2 million people around the world. Lowell traveled the world, essentially, with his Lawrence of Arabia lecture. And then he wrote a book on Lawrence of Arabia, the first of those 100 books, the first of the dozens of biographical accounts of Lawrence's adventures. He made T. Lawrence famous, and he made Lawrence of Arabia pretty much a household name for quite a while, and led to the Academy Award-winning film on Lawrence of Arabia by David Lean.
Yes, you are talking about these lectures, but in the book you also call them multimedia presentations. Before we even had a term like multimedia, what would it have been like to get a ticket and go there to watch Lowell Thomas present his lecture? How did he weave things together?
So Lowell would take the stage all by himself, this, you know, medium-sized man with a very big voice, and he'd invite people to go back to with him to a land of mystery and romance, you know, stereotypical view of the Middle East. And meanwhile, stationed in the middle of the orchestra in a steel booth wearing an asbestos suit would be Lowell's cameraman, Harry Chase, madly switching between essentially a slide projector and a film camera, going back and forth to project images on the screen that Lowell would then talk over. Again, these are the years before sound film, so this is really your only chance to get narrated film. And it was quite spectacular. You'd be seeing images of the Middle East, some of them colorized by hand. And you'd be seeing film of the pyramids. You'd be seeing film from an airplane. These are early in the days of air travel, over the pyramids. And it was a spectacular experience. There was music. He'd have a band playing often. He might have a dancer. It was quite an evening's entertainment for those days, and I think maybe even for our day.
Yeah, I guess since the invention of the talkie, the film with sound, we've sort of taken that for granted and can't imagine a time like this when Lowell Thomas would be presenting, in effect, a film with sound, the sound of his voice narrating what was on the screen.
Yeah, and also we live in a world that's been so heavily photographed. There's almost nothing about the world, no place in the world, Antarctica, you know, the jungles of Africa and South America, we've seen images of all these things. People hadn't in those days. You know, if somebody comes back from a trip and wants us to sit there and, and go through their iPhone and look at all these pictures, after a while, we get a little bored. In those days, this was a big thrill. You were seeing something that you hadn't seen before. And he brought back some of the first photographs and certainly some of the first film of some of these faraway places. Alaska and the Yukon initially, then Arabia, and then Afghanistan. You made it into Afghanistan, another country that didn't really accept a lot of foreigners, in a Buick over the Khyber Pass and across the sands into Afghanistan, where he filmed the Emir, and later into Tibet and into Antarctica and all these places. A lot of these places people first saw through the work of Lowell Thomas.
Well, we've talked about Lowell Thomas's adventures in various media, radio, the use of film and silent film and so on, and newspapers. But I see that in your book, May 3rd, 1939, marked what you say is arguably the country's first television news broadcast from the World's Fair. And that newscast, that first TV newscast, was presented by none other than Lowell Thomas, opening, I guess, a kind of new chapter in his technological journalism career.
Yeah, Lowell was very alert to new technologies. You know, we think this is a new thing in journalism to have some people who are always up to date on the latest gizmo. And, you know, Lowell was early using a portable typewriter. Lowell was early riding in automobiles. He was early filming from airplanes. He was early on the radio. He was early doing remote radio. He was early with film and his uses of photography. And when TV started reaching the point where you could actually reach a few sets around, say, New York City on an experimental NBC network, who was the first to deliver the news on this new medium? Of course, it was Lowell Thomas. And then when NBC decided to do some regular broadcasting to the few thousand TV sets that existed in New York at this time, this is 1940, what they did is they got Lowell Thomas into a TV studio to do his radio newscast with these gigantic cameras in this overlit studio with very bold makeup on, so that he had the first regular TV newscasts in the United States, and maybe the first regular program of any sort in the United States. So another of the many Lowell Thomas firsts. Now, this early TV work was suspended because of World War II. And when it resumed after the war, Lowell really didn't want to play around so much with TV because it required him being tied to a studio. He liked to do his radio broadcast remote, for example, from his travels or from ski areas. He was a big ski aficionado. Besides, he was so big in radio, he didn't need TV, but he was the first really to do TV news.
Yeah, in fact, in your book, you've got a couple of quotes from him. He says, "On radio, you are accepted as a disembodied voice and given the authority of outer space. On TV," he said, "there's no fun looking at the same person night after night."
Yeah, he's probably wrong. We've gotten used to looking at the same person, the Walter Cronkites, the Anderson Coopers of the world, night after night. And some of this was an excuse. He just didn't like TV in those days meant you had to sit in a hot studio in New York City. He'd rather be traveling the world, and he had it fixed so he could do his radio broadcasts as he traveled.
Yes, and he could also do those radio broadcasts from his home in upstate New York.
Yeah, Lowell had, quite an interesting country home set up for himself. A farm he first purchased on this ridge above Pawling, New York, about an hour and a half north of Manhattan. And, he bought a house up there. He started entertaining up there. President Roosevelt came up there to manage a softball team, which would play against Lowell Thomas's team every summer. Babe Ruth played on Lowell Thomas's softball team at some point. That's how well known Lowell Thomas was, and he got some of his friends to move up there. He got, for example, Edward R. Murrow, whose politics were kind of different from Lowell, who represented some different things in American journalism. He got him to buy a farm up there with Edward, which Edward R. Murrow loved. and it was quite a place. And Lowell built a radio studio up there, and he paid for an engineer to stay up there so he could, during the nice summer months, so he could do his broadcast from right outside his home, an hour and a half north of Manhattan.
Lowell Thomas, from 1930 on until 1976, when he did his last radio newscast, was a household name and a household voice in so many homes. But during the Second World War and in the years after that, he was also a presence in movie theaters. We haven't talked about his movie tone newsreels. What were they like, and how did Thomas lend his distinctive voice to those?
Well, this is in the heyday of movie going, of film going, when, you know, the average American went to a movie once a week, actually went to the theater. And when they got to the theater, before the feature played, they would play newsreels filled with news from around the world. This is before television news caught on. And if you wanted to see images of Hitler's armies, for example, or you wanted to see images of Washington, D.C., or of Winston Churchill, well, the only way to see him was to go to a movie theater and watch. This is after film had gained sound, and watch these newsreels. Who should be the host of the largest, the most successful of those newsreels? Fox Movie Tone, but, of course, Lowell Thomas. So at once, he was the biggest force in radio news, and he was also the biggest force in newsreels. Indeed, you know, I've looked at these numbers a lot. I think it's safe to say that never in the history of American journalism has one person told the news to as large a percentage of the American population as Lowell Thomas did in the 1940s, at a very crucial time in the history of the United States during World War II, the bloodiest war in the history of the United States, costliest war. Let me just say one other thing. As I travel about promoting this book, the reaction I get from a lot of people, especially a lot of young people, is, wow, here's a guy we never heard of, and look at all the things he's done. And I'm initially taken back by that, taken aback because this was a guy that everybody had heard of. I mean, he was, you know, if you wanted to talk about, you know, the best known man in America, well, you know, you'd be talking about Charlie Chaplin, maybe. You'd be talking about Lindbergh. You'd be talking about President Roosevelt. And you'd be talking about Lowell Thomas. Everybody knew Lowell Thomas. And now very few people under the age of 65 know of this man, which says something about journalistic fame. But he was just astoundingly well known from, you know, hosting the most popular radio newscasts, from hosting the most popular newsreels, which were shown twice a week in movie theaters.
He also developed what was called Cinerama. What was that?
Well, we have some large screen movies now, fairly popular. The first large screen film process was called Cinerama. In order to make it, they had to film things using three cameras and project them on a big, wide, curved screen using three projectors. There'd be a little line in between the area where the different where the three images met. And this was wildly popular when it first started. It was a new technology. It was a way of presenting images of the world. And so, of course, who ended up producing most of the first Cinerama films but Lowell Thomas?
And they were popular ones, too, I gather.
Some of the most popular movies in the United States for some years in the middle of the 1950s were Cinerama films produced by Lowell Thomas. And Lowell did what Lowell always did. He went around the world and showed people things from around the world. Amazing sights from around the world, a tiger hunt in India, for example, or, you know, the pyramids, the wonders of the world, the pyramids of Egypt.
And he also did adventure shows and travel shows on TV as well.
Yeah, he started, you know, I'm in my 60s now, and most people in my generation remember our memory of Lowell Thomas has to do with a show called High Adventure with Lowell Thomas, which was shown on CBS for a little while in the 1950s and then repeated for a long time. And we'd watch the repeats where, again, Lowell did, as was his wont, travel stuff. He'd, you know, he'd do a show in New Guinea. He'd do a show in the Persian Gulf. He'd do a show in Africa. And this is one of the ways my generation first saw about the world and first also learned that it was possible, as Tom Brokaw in his Recollections on Lowell Thomas puts it, that it was possible to live an adventurous life, that it was possible to travel to these far-off places and see these far-off things. You know, in some ways, the Lonely Planet traveling generation was trained by Lowell Thomas.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it is would have astonished people who knew Lowell Thomas and knew of him in his heyday that today he's so little known. In fact, he published more than 50 books in his time, as well as all the other things he did. You say that maybe his not being known says a lot today about journalistic fame. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, there's I found a quote from some newspaper writer shortly after Lowell died saying, "Can you imagine? There may be a day when not everybody has heard of Lowell Thomas." That seemed unimaginable, when he died in 1981. And now, of course, that's the case. And I believe that's typical of journalistic fame. I'm already encountering a lot of people who have never heard of Walter Cronkite, which would have been unimaginable to my generation. My students now have not heard of Tom Brokaw. And I think one of the reasons for this is, you know, if you write novels, well, we still read old novels. If you wrote music or played music, well, we still listen to old music. We still look at old movies. But nobody spends much time looking at old news. And so, you know, we're really not looking at Lowell Thomas's newsreels. We're not listening to Lowell Thomas's news broadcast, as, you know, exciting as they were at the time. And so journalists tend to be, forgotten rather quickly.
The nature of news, I suppose.
Yes. Let me add one thing, which is Lowell Thomas told the news to this huge percentage of the American people and was known and trusted and was considered authoritative by such a huge percentage of the American people. And he was followed in that by people like Huntley and Brinkley and Walter Cronkite and Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather and Peter Jennings. There's nobody really who is that well known in journalism today. There's nobody in journalism today who is that trusted by such a wide swath of the American people. There's nobody in journalism today that has quite the authority that a Lowell Thomas, and he was the first of them, had, or a Walter Cronkite had, or an Edward R. Murrow had. I mean, that's one way journalism is changing. 20th century journalism was very much a time of these incredibly well-known, larger-than-life, authoritative, nonpartisan, trusted figures. 21st century seems to be journalism seems to be something different.
Thank you very much, Mitchell Stevens, for speaking about your book on Lowell Thomas. I enjoyed reading it immensely. It's a great read. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to a New Books Network interview with Mitchell Stevens, author of the new book, The Voice of America, Lowell Thomas and the Invention of 20th Century Journalism. Mitchell Stevens is a professor of journalism at New York University. His other books include A History of News and The Rise of the Image, The Fall of the Word, published by Oxford University Press. The interviewer was Canadian journalist Bruce Wark. Thanks to Adrian Mahai for technical operations in New York. And thanks to James A. Canavino Library, Archives and Special Collections at Marist College, USA, for granting permission to use excerpts from Lowell Thomas's radio newscasts. I'm Laura Landon for the New Books Network. In the words of Lowell Thomas, so long until tomorrow.